You took on the issue of abuse by law enforcement officers, and you believe federal judges are in a unique position, have an obligation to prevent abuse by law enforcement.
Well, I do feel strongly, and I've voiced my concern about it, that we have to be careful. Of all people, we need to guard against defendants being taken advantage of. It's really a easy thing to do if you're a judge or if you're a law enforcement person to abuse and mistreat people. There's not very many people who will stand up for most people. As you know, a lot of people feel if they're in jail, they deserve to be treated harshly and badly, and they're not very concerned about that. And I think federal judges have a special role to play in attempting to prevent that from happening. That's just personal.
We may point out an example here, as in the withholding of documents in the Oklahoma City bombing trial of Timothy McVeigh.
Brady versus Maryland is the name of the Supreme Court decision that requires the government to provide any document or any information that they discovered with all their resources that might be helpful to the defendant or supportive of any defense that he might have. That law, Brady versus Maryland, I'm afraid to say, is fairly frequently not abided by fully and completely. I think the prosecutors get a competitive, combative sense of mind, and they just don't often turn over things that they should.
Well, I interviewed Stephen Jones in this website, and he talked about that, the withholding of documents. So you were very much aware of all that.
I was, and am concerned about it still, although I'm not trying any criminal cases anymore.
Is this your term, civic murder?
Yeah, I've used that to aggravate my colleagues. By that, I simply meant that if we aren't very careful, the government will execute someone who didn't commit the crime. To me, if the system permits that, that's civic murder. I mean, that's one of the worst things we can do, is to allow or permit someone to be executed for a crime that they didn't commit. And that's why I really feel we need to be very careful about allowing them to exercise all the rights that they have under the law and should have.
Because we have executed innocent people.
Oh, we have executed them. I think it's still possible to do so. You know, Illinois passed a law. They quit executing them just because they found out. And I think the same thing could happen here in the state.
Now, in more recent times, with DNA evidence, that's helped to resolve some of that.
It has. And this Innocence Project has been a big help in that regard, too.
As a settlement judge, you were asked in 2002 to settle the case of the black Tulsa police officers. That suit had been going on since 1994.
Our friend Susan Savage was the mayor of the city of Tulsa during most or all of that time. At least she was when we resolved that case. And we simply just hammered out between representatives of the police, the Fraternal Order of Police, and the city and the litigants a policy that would allow them to continue and do that other than by litigation. It's not easy. Those are really difficult chores to get done. But we were able to work out a settlement after a long-winded case. I'll mention one other out in New Mexico. I went out there at the request of the judge. They had had a case been going on for 9 years in which each side had spent more than $25 million on attorney's fees and costs, and it wasn't even quite ready for trial yet. They were expected to spend $60 million on each side. I went out there with Cindy, my law clerk, on Tuesday morning, and we caught a plane back on Thursday. We were able to get that resolved, and that resulted in a good bit of publicity for the summary jury trial and settlement, alternative dispute resolution techniques.
There must be also maybe something about your personality that you're able to bring to play on this, you think?
I don't know whether I have unusual ability, but if I do have any, it probably comes from traveling with my father, the itinerant horse trader, as a young man in southeastern Oklahoma. And then Roger Fisher wrote a book. He's a Harvard law prof. He wrote a little book called Getting to Yes. And I think it's the attitude toward trying to resolve a dispute and to help persuade the parties if your views might help to resolve that dispute. More importantly, to get them to accept that as opposed to a winner-take-all type thing. And I've always believed that. I've worked at that pretty hard, and I have had good luck.
In 1978, you received the Outstanding Achievement Award from the Aero Club of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I don't know. That was primarily because I was acting chairman of the Civil Aeronautics Board. I don't think there's anything significant about my contribution to the Civil Aeronautics Board.
Okay, I'll give you that. But then maybe there's something more significant or interesting on how you got to the White House and what you drove up in.
Okay, that's a story that, although true, has been frequently cited and quoted. I received an invitation from the Ford White House to attend a dinner at the White House. Marianne desperately wanted to go. Since I say she's very social, I was really a little bit reluctant to do it, but I finally thought I'd persuade her not to. I said, I'll go on one condition, that I can drive my old pickup up there. And it didn't bother her a bit. She's perfectly willing to do that. So we went to that White House dinner in a 72 Dodge Club Cab pickup. And as we were pulling in, the crowds were all hooping and hollering, and the guards were smiling, and we were the only pickup in the line. I was before Carter, so there wasn't any other pickups there. We were the only one there. They got word of it in the news media. Alan Cromley, I believe, was the White House correspondent, and they published it in the paper. So it's gotten an inordinate amount of publicity, but it was a fun deal, really.
The security had to be looking at this twice and three times.
They didn't understand it at all. They just couldn't hardly believe it, but there wasn't any basis for them to reject me, so they let me through. And the guards couldn't help but smile. You know, they had a whole lineup of military guards, and they all got a kick out of it as well.
Your courtroom is always interesting, as in the trial for defendant Alfred James Prince, who was accused of robbing a Duncan, Oklahoma savings and loan.
Alfred J. Prince was a big, sturdy, young African-American who robbed a savings and loan down there, which made it a federal offense. They captured him at Chickasha as he was trying to escape. We had a very outstanding young black attorney with our defense set up here, and I appointed him to represent him. He was a good lawyer. They got along just fine at first, and then shortly before the trial was scheduled to start, the attorney came in and said, Judge, I need to be released from that. And I said, why? And he said, well, Alfred J. Prince, he's been over there in the city jail and talking to all these lawyers. He wants to file a bunch of really frivolous motions that I can't represent him on as an officer of the court. And when I told him that, he quit talking with me. He said he won't communicate with me. So I said, well, I'll give him a hearing and let him sort of explain, but he's entitled to a lawyer, and I've appointed him a good lawyer. He can't pick and choose among the lawyers that he wants. We got him in the courtroom, and he refused to speak to me. Even he just remained mute. So on the morning that we were scheduled for trial, we had the jurors in there and brought him in. As we were attempting to voir dire the jurors, ask them about their qualifications, he stood, dropped his trousers, and attempted to urinate on defense counsel. He didn't hit him, but he just kind of covered the counsel table and the floor and everything. Well, we got the jurors out of there, and I tried to talk with him a little bit about demeanor, and it wasn't registering. So I sent him to Springfield to find out if this was contrived or whether he was really suffering some mental difficulties. And in the meantime, I got all sorts of gifts from my colleagues. They gave me hip boots and shower caps. And Springfield finally determined up there that he was motivated to do this. It was not any mental deficiency, that he was calculated and designed. So we did go ahead and try him, and he was convicted. And the circuit court, in their opinion, wrote a kind of clever comment. They said incontinence was not equivalent to incompetence in the Western District of Oklahoma, something to that effect. Alfred J. Prince. The worst thing about that was that Andy Coates, my dear friend Andy Coates, dean of the law school, he went all around the state telling everybody that Alfred J. Prince was his hero. He said he not only exercised his First Amendment rights in expressing his opinion of Judge West's court, but he represented about 95% of the lawyers who has ever appeared in Judge West's court. And I have no defense for that.
One more. In 1982, you had the case involving the counterfeit E.T. doll, the stuffed versions of the extraterrestrial in Steven Spielberg's movie. And you got that case.
I remember I granted an injunction to enjoin them from violating that copyright trademark. They stopped them out here. It was during the fair, I think, the state fair, as a matter of fact.
So did you have the E.T. doll?
Had the E.T. doll at the hearing, of course.